Accession number 20895, Reel 1.
John Day, Reel 1. Where were you born, please?
Exeter, Devon.
Which year was this?
1922.
Did your mother and father both come from Exeter?
My mother was Cornish. My father came from Essex.
And did you grow up and have your schooling in Exeter?
Yes.
What did your father do for a living?
He was working for the Great Western Railway.
Which school did you go to in Exeter?
Exeter School, from the age of 11 onwards.
And how old were you when you finished there?
17 years and about 9 months.
So the war had already started?
Yes.
Did you hear Neville Chamberlain declare war on Germany?
I think so. My memory says yes, but...
How did you feel about the news?
It was not, of course, unexpected. I think my main reaction at the time was concern about whether I would then still be able to join the Royal Marines, as I had already applied to do so. I was hoping to obtain a regular commission in the Marines, and I thought that possibly with the outbreak of war, this might upset that particular thought. I think that was my main preoccupation.
What had put it into your mind to join the Marines?
I was, from the age of about, I suppose, 14, 15, anxious to go into the services. My first choice was the RAF. But there was family opposition to that because it was considered to be too dangerous. And the attraction of the Marines, apart from the fact that I was interested in the sea and also in the soldiering aspect, it seemed a natural line to follow. The main advantage was that in those days, the training for Royal Marines did not take place at a cadet college. And therefore my family would not be faced with the expense of paying if I was at Sandhurst or Cranwell.
Did the war affect you at first?
Not really, no. I carried on working for my examination. We played rugger. This was my last term at school. I don't really think it affected me, except my interest in what was happening, of course.
So you weren't in any bombing by the German Air Force?
Not in 1939, no.
What do you remember happening to you next?
The next thing was, in succession, I suppose, the examinations, the interview, the medical exam for the Royal Marines, which took place in late November and December 1939, and then waiting to hear the result, which came out on, I think, the 24th of December. I passed.
And then?
preparing to join the Marines at Plymouth, coming up to London for fitting of the uniform, and in whatever we joined at Plymouth, I think, on the 14th of January, so that period of just over 2 weeks was fairly well occupied. I think I made two trips to London to the tailors, and there were, of course, the usual sort of parties as I ended school days and started to grow up.
And then?
There were 20 of us who joined the Royal Marines as what they called then probationary second lieutenants. I was, I think, the second. I wasn't the youngest, I was the next one in terms of age. So we varied in age from 17 years, 10 months as I was, to I think somewhere around the 19 years old. Six of us joined at Plymouth, I think six at Chatham and the remainder here at Eastleigh for some sorry, 3 months or three and a half months of preliminary training, which was mainly barrack square drill and physical training. Then we all gathered together sometime in April 1940 here at Eastleigh, the whole batch, 20 of us, for the naval aspects of our training. We did some preliminary naval gunnery based on the naval gunnery here at Eastleigh Barracks, followed by a short electrical course at HMS Vernon, and then finally it would have been, I should think, about 2 months at Whale Island, HMS Excellent, where we did the ordinary naval sub-lieutenant's gunnery course. After that, we all moved, the whole batch then moved down to Plymouth for a signals course and a course in administration, I think it was. I'm not absolutely certain about the sequence, but there was a little bit of a hiatus, in as much the training school to which we were going was not yet ready for us. So the winter, end of 1940, early 1941, we were split up and detached to army units along the Kent coast. Another chap and myself joined the 12th Battalion, the Devonshire Regiment, which was a medium machine gun battalion. And we spent, as I say, 6 to 8 weeks with this unit. Somewhere west of Deal on the coast.
What was that like?
Very cold. It was heavy snow on the ground, and we were, of course, very green. And I think we spent most of our time visiting the machine gun company's machine gun posts, which were scattered along the coast between Deal and, as I say, west of Deal, not east, if I said east. It was an interesting interlude in a period, long, longish period, as it had been then, a year of being hassled and harried along as part of our training courses.
Had you thought at that time that the Germans might invade?
Yes, now I think this is 1940, that's Christmas 1940, 1941, yes. There was that feeling, though we'd had one scare, the invasion, when I was at Plymouth in September doing this signals course. I'd been invited by a Marine captain and his wife that I'd got to know there to make up a foursome with the captain's sister. And we went out to a hotel on the outskirts of Plymouth. I've forgotten the name of it now, not that it matters, for a dinner dance on a Saturday evening. And when we were there, we heard an announcement. They stopped the band playing, and all service personnel were to return to their units. So off we went back to Plymouth. And we found that there was an invasion scare. An emergency battalion was formed in the Marine barracks there. And it's a curious episode that I often wish Evelyn Waugh had witnessed, and he could have put it in his books on his period with the Marines. Very few of the 20 second lieutenants there doing this course had a personal weapon. I was lucky. I'd been given a First World War .455 Webley revolver. I'm not sure I had any ammunition for it, but that's neither here nor there. But I had a revolver. And so those of us, I think four or five of us, who had weapons were appointed as platoon commanders in this emergency battalion. And we marched out of Plymouth Barracks somewhere in the small hours of the Sunday morning to the, forgotten the name of it, the Plymouth football team, the professional Plymouth football team. Well, we took
Plymouth
up
Argyle.
Plymouth Argyle, that's right. Took up defensive positions in the stadium there. In my diary, I recorded that at dawn we took up a defensive position there. What it was, I have no idea. And then very soon after that, somebody found out that the whole thing was phony, and we formed up and marched back to barracks. So, sorry, going back to your question, yes, when we were at Deal, there was still some threat, I suppose, of an invasion from the Germans.
When the crisis had occurred in the summer of 1940 with the fall of France, had you thought the Germans might win the war?
I do not recall at any time during the war thinking that. Somehow, something one just could not accept. I do remember the outbreak of war. I had a school friend who lived outside Exeter, and I used to go and stay with him in the country. And I was there when the Germans declared, or when we declared war. And I remember he and I talking, and remember there had been a long period of 12 months or so build-up to, is it going to be a war? And we talked and thought, well, you know, there was a feeling of relief that now it's come, now we know where we stand. And I remember a similar feeling of relief, strange enough, here at Eastleigh, when the French capitulated. And, well, foolishly, again, there was a sort of feeling of relief. Well, now we know where we are. Curious reaction.
Did you see anything of any hostilities whilst you were in the Deal area?
No, no. The only trouble there was driving round in a 1,500-weight truck in the small hours of the morning through the very heavy snow they had there to these various machine gun posts.
Any incidents that happened to you whilst you were with the 12th Devons there?
No, no.
So what happened next?
Well, then we went to Browndown. I may have got the sequence mixed up here, but this is about that sort of period, because I was at Browndown when Portsmouth had its first bad night bombing on the 14th of January, 1941. Browndown, do you know where Browndown is? Yes. Across the water, yeah. It was the Marine Small Arms School. And I had a girlfriend here in Portsmouth who was a Wren, not my wife. And I had come across here, and we'd gone out of Portsmouth onto the Portsdown Hills, because it was a change to get out of the town, when the bombing started. And she, of course, was anxious about her family, and so we had to walk back into the bombing. And that was when I was at Browndown, and I couldn't get back that night. And I think there was another chap who had also come into Portsmouth, and we two were missing at Browndown that night. They were relieved when they both turned up sometime the next morning.
What are your memories of the bombing of Portsmouth?
Well, remember I spent it with my girlfriend and her parents in a, what was it called, an Anderson shelter, was it, in their garden? Noisy. I don't think, I mean, you heard a lot of bombs coming down. I don't remember anything very near us. I remember her father was worried about any damage to the house, and he'd get out occasionally and look around, and I'd go out with him. My other memory was making my way to the dockyard, because there was a ferry from the dockyard across to Gosport, and there I knew I'd get a bus back to Browndown. Walking through Portsmouth, and somewhere around, I've never been quite able to spot it since I came back, but it's all changed so much there, but it must have been somewhere around coming into Portsmouth Hard, going before you got to the Vernon, there was a long wall, and I remember there was a body lying along the pavement covered with some I can't remember what, but it was covered with a, might have been a long coat or piece of rag, I don't remember. But I do remember that quite vividly. That was one of my memories. And of course, getting to the dockyard and finding so many people there hustling around, trying to get to their ships, some trying to get on the ferry back to Gosport. That's my memory of it, really.
What do you remember happening next?
Well, from the small arms school, we had some excitement, as we had here. There were daylight raids in Portsmouth when we were here in June, July, August. And if you were duty officer, as I would be in turn, in a daylight raid, you had to go up the clock tower here.
This is at Eastney?
Yes, here at Eastney. And the clock tower had, there might have been plates of steel, but certainly there were sandbags there, an old Lewis gun. I'm never quite sure what was meant to do with a Lewis gun. Anyways, duty officer, you'd get up there, and I think there was, I mentioned the orderly sergeant was with me, and I think that was all just the two of us there. And we had, if my memory is correct, and I wouldn't swear to this, but I think it was a voice pipe down to the brigadier, the commandant, who was possibly way down below ground, underneath the clock tower. I don't think it was a phone, I think it was a voice pipe. And one was meant to pass down any information that one could gather in terms of aircraft flying around. I remember making a bit of, not for the first time or the last time in my life, making a bit of an idiot in myself, because I could see aircraft flying way over Hayling Island in that direction. And I got a feeling maybe the all clear had gone, but anyway, they were coming up, shouting up to me, is it all clear, or something like that. And I was saying, no, there are aircraft, I can see aircraft flying over, and I gave them a compass direction or something like that. And eventually it transpired that was the RAF. I think not fighters, but they'd flown off so that they wouldn't be caught on the ground, and they were circling around from, presumably from Tangmere. So that was that. It was a funny little incident that was stuck in my memory.
And then?
I took us to Plymouth, and then there was the Brown Down, the small arms course, and there were air raids again. Of course, we were very near the Leon Sennett airfield there, but nothing of great interest, nothing particularly sticks in my mind, except we manned the Bren gun there, and I know some of my batch opened fire sometime, and they were accused of flying fleet air on planes. But I wasn't involved. From there, we moved down for the final course, which was, I think, called the military course, to what was then the new marine establishment at Lymston, which is now, of course, the commando school. And there we were supposed to be instructed in tactics. It was a military course. And it's the first time, really, that we were instructed by officers. Everything else, although overseen by officers, we were virtually in the hands of either NCOs or, in the case of the naval courses, petty officers. So it was interesting from that point of view, and we felt that, you know, we were now getting to the end of our, well, we were getting to the end of our training. That was pleasant enough, and of course I was on home ground, inasmuch that the countryside was well known to me. An advantage that perhaps wasn't entirely on my side, because there were too many distractions locally, which perhaps took my mind off the course. But I was at home there, on home ground. I knew the area well. And then, I think the course was meant to be a 3-month course, something like that. And somewhere about round about the middle of April, we were told that our course was being cut short by 2 or 3 weeks, and we were all being sent off to the Royal Marines Division, which was then in Scotland. I don't know if it was expressly stated or may have just been implicit that our course was cut short, and we were being sent off because the division was going to undertake an operation. And so off we all went. 20 of us, or we were then 21, and somebody had come, joined us from an earlier batch who'd been injured, James Agnew. We went off and split up amongst the various units of the Royal Marines Division. I was, I reckon, very lucky in that with a man who became perhaps my best friend in the Corps, Paddy Stevens, who died last year. Lucky in the sense that we were posted to the 1st Battalion, Royal Marines, which was commanded by Lieutenant Colonel Wildman Lushington, and had various people that I came to know better in subsequent years serving, and I first got to know them there. The operation for which we rightly felt that we had been hurried up north was cancelled. I think it involved some of the islands in the Atlantic, some of the Portuguese islands. I know later on we were definitely involved with plans to take over Madeira, but I don't know if this was the first operation or not. But there were, I think, a couple of occasions between we joined there about the end of April and until possibly the end of July, when we were understood we were about to go on an operation. And that was pleasant enough. We were platoon commanders, Paddy and I, and we were training. We would go into the old, if you want the names of ships, I would have to refer to my books, but
don't worry about them.
Landing ships infantry, you know, sort of thing, the converted liners, that sort of thing, up to Inverary for exercise in landing operations. And then, sometime about, I can't remember exactly, but probably end of July, something like that, we had been in 102 Royal Marine Brigade, and we were then moved to join the 1st Guards Brigade, replacing the 1st or 2nd Battalion, I can't remember which, of the Hampshire Regiment, and we took over the Hampshire Regiment's base at Duns in Berwickshire. And so this is rather thrilling, but interesting, novel, to be part of an army brigade. It was the 3rd Battalion Grenadier Guards, 2nd Battalion Coldstream, and 1st Battalion Royal Marines. And we had not been there very long when I was told I was to be what they then called a motor contact officer. Each battalion in the brigade nominated an officer as a motor contact officer, which I suppose later would have been known as a brigade liaison officer. And I was taken away from my platoon and given this job. So I saw the workings of an infantry brigade headquarters to a good degree. It was by no means any intimate arrangement. But this was interesting.
And what work were you supposed to be doing as a motor contact officer?
Well, on exercises, for example, one was supposed to liaise between the brigade headquarters. We worked with the brigade IO, who was called Howard. Now, I've often wondered, but I don't think it's the man who eventually became a military historian, although I think they were both grenadiers. I'm not sure. I can't remember. It's not important anyway. But we worked to the brigade IO. And the idea was that one was used to either to pass instructions down to the CO or to report back to brigade headquarters with the situation in the battalion area. I mean, we only did this in the exercises we carried out. I cannot really remember what I did when we weren't on exercises. I must have done something. But that didn't last very long. I think perhaps 6 or 8 weeks. And in fact, I think possibly we didn't move to Duns, although we did relieve the Hampshires at Duns, and we did relieve them in the in Guards Brigade. But no matter. Anyway, we came out of the brigade, and that had been specifically for an operation. I don't remember ever being formally briefed on the operation. But I think it was one of the islands. We used to sometimes think, are they the Balearic Islands, those islands there in the Mediterranean?
Yes.
That was aired at some stage, but I think that might have been guesswork. Anyway, we were then told we were standing down and we were no longer under any form of notice for operations. We came out of the Guards Brigade and rejoined the 102 Royal Marine Brigade, which included, I can't remember which other Royal Marine Battalion, but also the 8th Battalion, the Argyll and Sutherland Highlanders. And then, having come out of the Guards Brigade, therefore I was no longer a motor contact officer, I became assistant adjutant, because as we were stood down for operations, we moved into Berwickshire, we were told to undertake agricultural assistance. And so, as assistant adjutant, I had the task of going around the farms in Berwickshire, which had its enjoyable aspects. One was always very warmly treated, partly out of natural behaviour towards our soldiers, but also partly because I governed the amount of labour that they obtained, so there may have been a bit of scratch my back and we'll scratch yours. So that worked very well, and I was responsible for this. It was a break from the normal training, and it didn't last very long, but most of it was concerned with picking potatoes up to the ground. And then, somewhere around September, latter half of September, the rest of my batch disappeared, and they all went off to sea appointments. And I was the only one of the 21 left behind, and this was because Tim Gray, who was the adjutant, and I'd been his assistant doing this agricultural run, he was going off to the Staff College, and Wilburn Lushington decided that I should be his replacement at the age of 19 and a half. And so I became adjutant of the 1st Battalion in that September. Green as grass, really. But a job that I much enjoyed, because it obviously stretched me beyond the normal sort of doings. I must have been about the youngest officer in battalion, and I was certainly the only regular subaltern. One or two came along later. The company commanders were, I think, almost all regulars. So that was beginning to change. Evelyn Waugh had been in the battalion, but he left before I joined it, but there were stories abounding about him at that time.
What kind of stories?
Oh, apocryphal, I suppose. About him calling somebody an idle hedge priest. I've forgotten who it was now he called that. And the stories about him wearing his silk pyjamas on exercises and his wine and so on. I can't remember the details. Things you might expect. And he disappeared. He went off, of course, with the commandos. When he came back, he tried to come back, but Wilburn Lushington wouldn't have him. Then Wilburn Lushington left about December and went off to Combined Ops Headquarters, which was by which time Mountbatten was the chief of Combined Ops, and he went later with Mountbatten to SEAC. And Jumbo Lester took over as CO. Jumbo Lester had been the G1 of the Royal Marine Division up to this time, and then he took over the battalion as CO. And I stayed there as adjutant until about April, when the Royal Marine Office, incidentally, Adjutants were all captains. The Royal Marines Office refused to make me an acting captain because I was too young. But they did pay me the adjutant's half crown a day, so it wasn't really too badly off there. Eventually, they got hold of me and sent me to sea in about, must have been the end of April, I should think, 1942, this is now.
In which ship?
HMS Howe, which was commissioned on the 1st of June, appropriately enough, because she was named after, of course, Admiral.